CliffCentral.com.
All right, we are live. CliffCentral.com on a Tuesday morning. We do indeed have another episode of Blind History coming at you this morning, and it's Nostradamus, someone who we've had lots of requests for. Nostradamus, the historical figure, very interesting guy, and a lot more story there than I thought there would be. And we'll also talk a little bit about his predictions a bit later on. You're a big fan, hey, Mbulelo?
I think more from a bit more myth than legend, or more legend than actual fact. But, I'm a huge fan of Blind History, so
yeah,
I'll listen to anything. I'd listen to anything on that show. I love it. I absolutely love that podcast.
Yeah, and no, it'll be fun. I think you'll enjoy today's episode. It's coming up a little bit later on. We're almost at the end of Blind History Season 5, and we have to start talking about what's next. Do we carry on? Are there more people? Are there more things we need to cover? Where do we go from here? So we've got to do that. We're recording, I think, the final two episodes on Thursday. Anthony's coming up to Joburg, and we're going to be doing it in studio, so that'll be fun. All right, a few things that we need to get into this morning. We haven't had a chance to yet, what with all the Charlene Surtee Richards discussions, the talk about the Pan-African Parliament, JJ Cornish. Bill Gates and Warren Buffett are apparently building a nuclear reactor in Wyoming, which is one of the most coal-rich parts of America. You have to wonder, I'm all in favor of diversifying your portfolio, but you have to wonder whether there isn't it's a bit of a mockery of the rest of us. I mean, most of us don't have enough money even to pay our bills, let alone start up a nuclear reactor in Wyoming, when we actually come from, in Bill Gates's case, an IT background. And if you're Warren Buffett, you're an investor. But Warren Buffett, buys products and goods and shares in companies that produce goods and services. And now he's thinking of building a nuclear reactor with Bill. These two really don't know what to do with their money. You can tell, like, there is a point where you are so rich that you actually don't know what to do with your money. I think that's what's happened here.
Must be nice, but also it seems like it's been in the works for quite a long time.
Oh yeah.
Bill Gates has a nuclear reactor design company called Terra Power, and he founded 15 years ago. And then Warren Buffett's company, Berkshire Hathaway, owns a power company called Pacify Corp.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't know how old that company is, but between the power company and the nuclear reactor design company, it's owned by both of them. They're now partnering up for this. So it seems like they've been thinking about this for quite a long time. They've roped in the Department of Energy in the US as well.
Mm-hmm.
And this is already, the plans are underway for this.
Yeah, building a nuclear reactor, that's like Mr. Burns money. Mr. Burns from The Simpsons?
Excellent, Smithers.
I mean, that's where Homer Simpson works. He's the richest man in the town of Springfield because he owns the nuclear reactor,
Yeah, all the power. They want all the power, everywhere, everything, all the time, quite literally.
I mean,
good for them.
I would love them to build a nuclear power station here for us. I'm a big fan of nuclear.
No.
I'm a huge fan of nuclear power, and I would love them to build one here. Then we wouldn't have to use Eskom. I'd be happy to pay Mr. Burns. I mean, Bill Gates and Warren Buffett for power. As long as we would have a reliable power source, I don't see anything wrong with that. They could build it somewhere in the Northern Cape. No one lives there.
Oh, the ANC would get their hands on it, Gareth. Before you knew it, it would be derelict. No, I don't want those disgusting people getting another cent. No, Bill Gates and they must keep their money. Keep it there where there's rules and people actually respect rules. No, don't bring it here. We some people don't deserve nice things, and I don't think enough people have heard that. Of us don't deserve nice things.
But Mbulelo, we need power. You're cutting off your nose despite your face.
No, keep the power. You know what? We deserve the politicians we get. The Bill Gates, please keep your money with your own people. Let your own people enjoy the fact that you've wanted capitalism. Don't bring it here. So I'll no, thank you.
All right.
We don't deserve it.
Huge amounts of cynicism.
Well, they still say it's more fuel efficient, it's cost effective, and they say it's safer than traditional nuclear reactors. They say what they're building has the ability to power up 400,000 homes. And then, of course, politicians are getting involved because they're just excited to be able to look in this light. Mm-hmm. The Wyoming governor, Mark Gordon, says that the project will create hundreds of jobs in the state.
Yeah, sure.
And he added that the exact location of the project will be announced by the end of this year.
Awesome.
Well,
Like little tidbit in this announcement video that Bill Gates did for this project, who is still wearing his wedding ring, if anyone cares.
Yeah, shame. His reputation's taken a huge knock since it's come out that he was also friends with Jeff Epstein, huh? Have you seen that?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, a lot of people are talking about that. Mm-hmm. So Silas says, that's all good, but the ANC is our Homer Simpson, but dumber.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Silas is right. There. Silas must see. All right. Bulelo, you seem to develop a problem with a couple of things. I know that I'm aware of the fact that you have a problem with Netflix and Amazon Prime as well. You've developed some issue over this.
I wouldn't say a problem. Like, I got Netflix like 3 weeks ago, and there is so much on there, right? Yeah. I've never had Netflix in my life,
right?
Why do people need both? How do you get to all the stuff on Netflix already and have time to go, you know what? I need another platform with thousands of shows on it. Is in an adult life, where do people find the time? And I'm maybe the most self-centered person in the world. I only care about myself. There is nobody else in my life who I ever think about in the day.
Yeah.
And I don't have time.
Yeah.
So where do people get time?
I heard just in the last 3 days of three more series that people say, oh, you've got to watch this, you've got to watch that. And Sia just brought up the Underground Railroad, which I also want to see. There's so much to watch. Who's producing all of this stuff? Like, it's just unbelievable. The entertainment machine is clearly working overtime at the moment. And listen, it's great because, I mean, for a lot of people, they're sitting at home. They're still in fear of coronavirus. They need something to entertain themselves. They don't have work. Joe Biden's giving them huge amounts of money. So in America, why not watch TV? You know, that's all you can do.
It's incredible to me. It's incredible that people have time.
It's just way too much for me. Even I struggle to watch a series back to back to back.
Yeah.
I have to study it. Gosh, I don't know how many people have the time.
You bring that up. So I've been watching Vikings from the first episode of season one, and I'm still not even at season six yet. And it's taken me, and I'm watching this with my sister and her boyfriend. It's taken us, I mean, we haven't watched even two nights a week, maybe is a lot, because you've got to find the time. And we're still only on end of season five now. So there's still so much to go. And I can't believe how long this series is. It's just, it's crazy. Like I keep going, are you sure there are more episodes?
Gosh.
That's just one fucking series. Can you imagine?
Do you ever have just a brief... Do you ever have just this 2 seconds of your heart dropping when you jump onto a new series and just like a new episode? And as you press play, you look at the time and it's 1 hour, 7 minutes.
Well, I feel that.
Didn't you have packed it into like 32 minutes?
I feel that way when we used to go to the movies, because I'd look at the movie and go, oh, it's two hours or more. How am I going to manage this? I know what's going to happen. Like halfway through, I'm going to go, oh, I wish I wasn't here anymore. It doesn't happen that way. I usually enjoy it. I mean, especially if I've chosen the movie and it's something I've heard good things about. Very seldom are you hugely, hugely disappointed. But if I am, I'll usually get up and just leave the movie. I mean, there's no need. You don't need to stay in a movie just because you paid for it and it's shit. I mean, if you've already sunken cost of like half an hour, you can get back a part of your life if you leave the movie after half an hour. If you've got a sunken cost of an hour, you may as well see it through, right?
I like what you're saying about walking away. I've made a mistake. This is a bad investment. Let me get out of here. I've done it plenty of times, and it's a great policy in life in general. Like, I'm big on moving on. Absolutely. This is terrible.
Absolutely.
Pivot.
Today is Leanne Moll's birthday, and Mike wants to just wish her a happy birthday. Well, she's not here today, but yes, I hear it. Orksy Head says, please close down Kuberg. Yeah, that's a nuclear power station. And build it in the Northern Cape. How long till the useless cunts fuck up Kuberg and Cape Town is the next Chernobyl? Yeah, especially when you combine like CADA deployment, a flirtation with socialism and nuclear power. You know how that goes. And if you watch that miniseries, I mean, that was just an unbelievably brilliant miniseries. So, so good. Then you'll see what can happen and how badly it can go wrong. So maybe Mbulelo was on the money when he said, please don't bring nuclear here. The ANC will ruin it. It's a good point. Adonis says, the only way to be independent of Eskom is solar, no nuclear. I'm with Mbulelo. Nuclear is extremely expensive. Well, it's not just that it's expensive. It also produces a whole lot more power. If you want solar, you need to build, like, you have to cover most of the Karoo. Most of the Karoo in solar panels, and we know what's going to happen. They're not going to be maintained. Nuclear is actually cheaper in the long run because it produces so much more power. You know, for every little bit of nuclear fuel that you need to put in there, you produce millions and millions of joules of energy. Whereas with solar, you have to build these enormous, enormous solar arrays in order to bring in like enough power for 6,000 houses or whatever. And wind is the same. We're not yet at the stage where we can harness those powers effectively enough. And this is not my opinion. This is what all the big nuclear and the big energy scientists are saying. So remember the very complicated part of solar is that a lot of the components of solar have to be mined in countries where people are desperately dirt poor. A lot of those components are made of minerals and are put together by slave labor. They mine from minerals that are extremely costly to dig out of the earth. But of course, the people who dig them out of the earth are usually very, very miserable and poor. And we're probably doing more damage with the mining than anything else. So, you know, this whole idea that solar is better than nuclear is actually a bit of a joke. And Donna,
it's not. It is not, solar is not an option. I mean,
no. You know, even again, in a very sunny country like ours.
No, solar is probably the worst way to do things right now, purely because of the limitations you've already expressed. And you know, this one's an interesting one, Gareth. And you know, my position is I tend to be skeptical of scientific conversations unless people know how to read science. Is that you know, this is a tricky one, and I think you've articulated it beautifully, is that be careful of solar is the solution to everything.
Oh,
it is riddled with incredible amounts.
You're just believing the politicians when you start parroting that nonsense, and not just the politicians, but the environmental lobby, which is even more ridiculous. Nuclear energy these days is a lot safer than it's ever been. There are these pebble bed modular reactors, which we were talking about building back in the, you know, early 2000s, which are largely safe. I mean, they, you know, the amount of actual dangerous nuclear fuel is very, very small. And the way that they distribute it, it's very hard for these to melt down in a Chernobyl sense. So I think that, you know, if you're going to talk about these things, you actually need to know how nuclear energy works. They're also, by the way, developing fusion reactors. And they're getting very, very close to developing these to the extent that they say, again, these are the futurists now, so we're talking in theoretical terms rather than practical ones. But they say they'll eventually be able to develop little power stations the size of a suitcase that can power up entire suburbs and neighborhoods, because these fusion reactors will work on a principle of actually pushing together the nuclei of two atoms. And that will produce so much excess energy. And if we can harness that effectively, we will never, ever need to use coal, oil, solar, wind, or anything like that again. And the chances of it getting out of control and being extremely dangerous are very limited. So, I mean, that's potentially something that could save us as well. A fusion reactor would be amazing.
I have a friend who works at the Large Hadron Collider, and she's always kind of keeping me up to date with some of the cool stuff they're working on, which obviously isn't the top secret stuff, but this is a huge focus for some of the stuff that they're doing there is alternative sources. And there are real scientists. I don't mean these people who want to come and talk at in Davos and these people who want to be seen in front of cameras. Real hardcore scientists that are really working on this problem, that are doing incredible things. And don't expect the path forward to be linear. these genii continue to surprise us all the time. In, I promise you, in 15 years' time, we're going to be shocked at some of the solutions aren't even talking about.
Let's just look
at some. People are magnificent.
Let's look at some of these comments. I agree with Winsterian Pikachu, who says that solar only works for your private home. Well, it is still a good solution for your private home, but it's still really expensive. I mean, you need to lay out at least $100,000 if you're going to do it properly, and and you know that's to kind of get yourself off the grid. And even then, you still might rely on Eskom some of the time. I know people who've got complete solar installations, and they still use Eskom power. They use less of it, but they do. An interesting point being made here by Reno. He says, my concern with nuclear power is the toxic residue that is left behind. It remains poisonous for thousands of years. Just bear in mind that you live on a planet where there is constant radioactive decay going on in the core and the mantle and the crust of the Earth. There's constant radioactive decay. In fact, we know this is happening because it's how we do things like radiocarbon dating. So right now, under the soles of your shoes, there are rocks that are already radioactive, giving off radiation, alpha particles, beta particles, gamma even. Obviously, it's in highly dilute form because the Earth's been around for, you know, millions and millions of years. But the fact is that there is constant radioactive decay going on. You should be more concerned about the cosmic rays coming from the sun, which can mutate your DNA. But there is that we're surrounded by radiation in every moment of our day. So don't pretend that a little bit of spent nuclear fuel that they put in a barrel and drop down, you know, kilometer long shaft into the crust of the Earth, that somehow is going to make the world a whole lot more dangerous. There is already a huge amount of radiation going on around you, Reno. So don't get paranoid. I mean, I don't want anyone to wake up this morning and feel afraid because of what I've just said, but this is happening around us. Carla brings up a really interesting point. 20 years from now, the world is going to be powered by hydrogen fuel, and we are in a great position to produce this, making Africa the next fuel leaders. Well, hydrogen fuel really is something to look at, and the value of hydrogen, obviously, is that it's abundant. It's a constituent of water, among other things. There's a huge amount of hydrogen in the various compounds on Earth. It's easy to produce. It's cheap to produce. But the reason that we want to use hydrogen is because when you ignite hydrogen, it produces an enormous amount of energy. And then, of course, the only byproduct is water. So, yes, you're absolutely right, Carla. That's a good point. Why don't they build nuclear power stations on the moon and beam the electricity down to Earth, says Andre. Andre, if you can figure out a way to make that work, well, give it a go. I mean, why the hell not? Of course, says Bryn.
Listen,
of course,
the ANC can barely figure out.
Yeah. Go on. The ANC can barely figure out?
Oh, no, sorry. They can barely figure out how to get water into the homes of people. You want them beaming electricity from the moon here.
Not going to happen. But
I like it though.
Bulelo Brin says, of course, Bulelo has a friend at the Large Hadron Collider.
Excuse me, Bryn, have some respect. I once did some data capturing at the Large Hadron Collider. So if you thought that was being sanctimonious, I once worked at the Large Hadron Collider. So please have some respect, Archer.
Yes, obviously. Carla also makes this point. Does anyone ever question the fact what happens to all those used solar panels after their 25-year lifetime? Huge upcoming crisis. What are we going to do with all that waste? Very good.
Oh.
Fusion reactors, according to Yonder, are the safest and cleanest energy way forward. There is one already being built in China and also in Europe. I think Bill's going that way and not nuclear fission. Fission is where you break the nucleus of the atom. Fusion is where you put together a new nucleus. I think this is all very interesting. We've got to look at new ways of doing it. I mean, the fact that we still have to burn coal in Mpumalanga to power this country is kind of ridiculous. I know we've got abundant coal. I know that this is probably the most effective way to do it now, considering where we are technologically. But honestly, to me, there's no question that nuclear has to be the way forward. And I don't want the Russians doing it or the Chinese, because I don't trust those two countries at all. And as Mbulelo says, I don't trust our government either. But in terms of humanity's way forward, nuclear is absolutely the way to go. All right, that's enough.
The Scandinavs are doing it.
That's enough about energy. I'm all energied out this morning. I don't know about you guys in terms of like nuclear.
Is your energy depleted?
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, all right. All right. There are a couple other things on the agenda. Bulelo raises an interesting point, and this is something he's been holding out on until he was on the show with us. Does every person on earth have to be mixed race, gay, have had a sex change, or have been a drug addict to be considered non-toxic in the world today? Does everyone have to be soft to be listened to? Now, what do you mean by this, Bulelo? This is something that you wanted to bring onto the agenda.
You know, because I'm it'll be interesting to hear from you guys, but I'm a hyper masculine person. I'm into sports and aggression and strength. And in fact, I've been thinking about what do I miss most about school and playing sport at a really high level. What I miss is the locker room and the lads, because I'm a lad's lad. You know, I'm not like an empathetic person, an empath. Let's get along.
Yeah, you're the opposite of Sia in this respect. Yeah.
Well, I'm not going to speak on Sia's behalf.
Wow.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
Okay, sorry. Bulele, as you were.
Shout out to you, Sia. It's your safe space. And back then, it is. We all need, you know.
All right.
But everything now has, or not everything, but I perceive it as, and I guess because our consciousness is formed through Hollywood, is that, you know, when you talk about the hyper-masculine figure, it's always this idea that it's abusive to be hyper-masculine. And I think it's because so few people lack the ability to harness a masculinity that isn't going to be abusive. And I don't know what people are going through. But why does everything need to be soft and descend into just purely cerebral? And I feel like it's an interesting time for me to kind of observe the world, because even the Oscars and Hollywood and everything is be fabulous or you're toxic. And where's this coming from? And personally, for me, I'm like, no, I don't want that. I don't want to be a soft ass bitch. And if you want to be a soft ass bitch, that's fine. But I can still be hyper masculine. You know, you don't need to get in my way.
Like there's this idea that all masculinity and all cisgendered heterosexual masculinity is somehow toxic. It's become a very popular trope. And I think it's been, I think it's been fueled by the fact that there are so many grievance groups now. You know, if you are, if you're trans, then you must have a grievance against somebody. And the people at the opposite end of the grievance are usually those masculine, cisgendered, heterosexual males, and they just have to take it all on because, you know, they're the ones who can handle it, I suppose. So they have to take on everyone else's grievances, and it's always their fault. And you can't possibly be a good person and be those things.
And having said that, I am not a victim. I want to be very, very clear that I'm loving being hyper-masculine. I'm just wondering, what happens to meatheads like me now? Is it forever now?
No,
how dare I ever
get
screwed. A wife?
Sorry.
I'm done, huh?
No one cares about you. You're on your own.
Yeah.
You are.
Oh, my goodness. I need to change all my profiles and actually get a pride flag. That'll probably soften my image, huh?
You're one of the bad people. Lord. You're one of, and in Pride Month, you deserve no platform to speak on. In fact, I don't even know why we had you on the show this morning, because you obviously you're bringing all your toxicity here, and now you're ruining it for everybody else. How dare you?
And I haven't put a BLM fist on my social media. So what does that say about
me? Oh, you're a really terrible person. What's wrong with you? Awful.
Thought so.
So how do you guys see all of this panning out, this time that we're living in, and the culture that we have right now?
I think it's just a fad. I think what's going to happen is that we'll move on. People will move on. Things will get better. We will eventually realize that blaming each other for all kinds of things that we actually have to take responsibility for ourselves about is not going to achieve anything. And we will get to a stage where the people who want to get things done, want to move ahead, want to make a difference in the world, we'll just do that. And the ones who can't, we'll just keep on bitching, but we'll eventually have less and less time to listen to them.
I hope you're right.
Well, I can't see any other way, Mbulelo. I mean, this We cannot devote any more energy to hearing other people whining and moaning. There just isn't enough time in the day. And most of us have a list of things we want to get through. I've got a list of stuff that I have to do today. I'm going to be busy with that. I don't have time to stop and worry about all the grievance people and all the upset people and all the people who are sad because X, Y, and Z, and because, you know, once upon a time their daddy didn't hug them enough or whatever happened. It's none of my business. And you've got to realize that there are more people in the world who have genuine pressing needs, concerns, and have to survive, and will put your needs, your concerns, and your grievances at the end of their list, if at all, because they've got better things to do.
And you know why it's so pressing to me, why I actually wanted to talk about it, was that I'm constantly actively seeking alpha males and alpha females in my life, in business, in my personal life, because I believe true alphas, you know, this idea that being hyper-masculine is to destroy. I think being a female alpha or a male alpha is real alphas protect. They create environments and protect that environment.
Absolutely.
And which is why I seek these people who work incredibly hard to create large environments, protect those, and allow others to flourish whilst bait is such an easy word, but these, I don't know what these, what we call soft ass bitches now, is that they're in little corners scheming like cockroaches,
but also, you know, let them, because so what? I mean, in the long run, you can sit and moan and whine and carry on, but nobody's really got the time to listen to it. And people will pay you lip service. They'll be like, oh yeah, it's very important. Let's, you know, let's give you a day of international recognition or a day of what do they call it now? There was a thing the other day for pansexuals, and I thought, wow, pansexuals are people who love having sex with everybody. They're non-judgmental about whether it's a you know, a man or a woman or whatever, and that's fine. But now they need a day of it's a day of visibility, so we need to create a day of visibility. So it's fine. We give them a day of visibility. Does it really change anything? No. Does it make more people think about, you know, the plight of all those terribly evinced and unhappy pansexuals that are wandering the earth just without any succor at all, any kind of love, any kind of care? No, it doesn't. It doesn't change a damn thing. And it's pretty much patronizing at the most extreme end of the spectrum as well. So I just think we've got to move on. And while I hear you, I think there is a danger that we end up sounding like you and I are just uncaring, thoughtless, cruel, vicious, vindictive, selfish people. And that's what we'll be characterized as by the people who we're talking about here. But at the same time, there's going to be a point where people just go, oh, please, will you shut up? You know, like I think Caitlyn Jenner is the perfect example of this. Like she's just such a joke as a human being. And what she's done is she's actually damaged, I think, the significance of the whole trans movement for people who are genuinely going through a tough time or maybe having, you know, a whole lot of difficulty in their lives. Because she's such a ridiculous person that it makes a mockery of everything else. And there are a lot of examples like that. So I think we've just got to get on with it. We don't have time. We do have time for Blind History. That's coming up in a short while. Silas says we're in the snowflake era, to your point, Bulelo. Corona's Boring says, call them soft-ass bitches. That's what they are. Katu says, Bulelo is my new favorite. Please have him on every day. All right. Annette says, being heterosexual is so uncool these days. We will soon be completely cancelled. If heterosexual people are completely cancelled, who will make the children?
Yeah, it's true. It's being fabulous, unfortunately, doesn't work when you want to copulate and occupy a womb. Well said, Annette, and well said, Gary.
Yeah, and DPW says, thank you for the MKT show. Oh, that's nice. Yeah, how's it going on the MKT show? Give us an update. You need to do that.
Well, obviously, I've got COVID. We must never forget that. Hashtag.
Go on.
Gareth, it's going really, really well. And I know for a long time we've been saying there's a nice surprise coming up, but we can finally announce that next week we'll be launching a new look for the show, a new location for the show. Mm-hmm. And the support's been incredible. It's been absolutely incredible. So
good.
We'll finalize over the next 2 weeks, but you'll be seeing a new look, a massive upgrade in how we're delivering the product to you. So you can subscribe, Cliff Central Sport, on YouTube. Otherwise, it is Cliff C Sport on Twitter. Please subscribe, join the movement. And the support's been incredible, Gareth. And Cliff Central, we are going to be shaking up the way we deliver sports content to, number one, the continent. And ultimately, we want to be a global company, which is what we are as Cliff Central, and that's how we roll. So it's been incredible. Cliff Central right. Sport on YouTube. You can subscribe and follow along.
Very good. Do that and do it today. And while we're talking about subscribing, you need to like and subscribe to this show. Otherwise, you know, why are we doing this? So will you do the little like and subscribe thing like a professional YouTuber for us? Go, Mbulelo, you're on.
If you don't want to be a dickhead and you'd actually want to live in the 21st century, there is a like and there is a subscribe button here. CliffCentral.com, the only place not to be a soft ass bitch. Like, share, subscribe. Be a friend, tell a friend.
All right, very good. I like it. All right, Sia is trying to sort out blind history for us this morning. We're going to we may just end up having to play you the audio because we've got some kind of problem with the video, but we will upload that to YouTube a little bit later on, just in case you were wondering where that is. I thought this was quite funny. Someone sent this to me the other day, and Mbulelo, it's appropriate that you're here for this. This is divorce leads children to the worst places. And then it shows a mother and a father and the child falling into a pit of cycling. So I thought that was interesting. Also, since you are unlikely to ever find a life partner because you're so undesirable and because you've got such a terrible attitude, this is what the dating pool looks like in your 30s. Thought I'd just
that is no lie.
Yeah, that's what it looks like. And that's worth considering. There are also a bunch of messages here from people who are enjoying having you on the show this morning. If you like Mbulelo, you've just heard, you can go and watch him doing his own Cliff Central Sports Show, the MKT show, which you can go and subscribe to on YouTube as well. All right. One or two other things, just quickly. Apparently, you know what it costs for world leaders to travel to the G7 summit this week? Do you have any idea of what it costs?
I don't even want to know. Let me take a guess. What, for all of them or individually?
All of them. All of them together.
$50 million.
That would be great. It's more like $100 million just in security. Just the security costs to send all of these assholes to a meeting in England, not in like a dangerous place, like in the middle of the DRC near Goma, for example. It's not that. It's in Cornwall in England. $100 million.
Oh, by the way, that is the most lily place in the world. Cornwall is the most ridiculously boring. Nothing happens there. It is the most boring place in the whole world. No, honestly, the flowers are in more danger from nature than correct. Their politicians.
Yes, correct. $100 million is what the cost is for the world leaders to go and spend some time in Cornwall for the G7 summit this week. I'm outraged by this. And if you aren't, and you don't think that it's become a joke that these people put themselves in a position of authority over us, then I don't know how to help you. I don't know how to make it clear to you that you're being taken for a ride. Like, don't you realize when people are screwing with you, $100 million for their security?
I'm just thinking of the poor citizens of this place who now have all of this buzz and attention and way too much busyness than they bargained for. Just for some context, there's a population of about 3,500 rand in this carbon space, specifically in Cornwall.
Hang on. 3,500 people.
3,500 people.
Okay.
Now, mirror that with the fact that they have up to 5,000 officers and police staff who have been briefed and will be working on the G7 summit.
Okay.
For this week. 3,500 people in the whole freaking town, 5,000 officers and police staff will be brought in just for this. These officers already deployed in and around Cornwall and all over England.
Unbelievable.
The likes of specialist units of these police officers have been trained for months and dealing with potential protests and riot control, while 150 police dogs will also be deployed during the event. Wow. There have been drones that have also been ready and are on standby for any potential problems. And, you know, this is how you tally up to a very cool 70 million pounds, which is the equivalent of about 100 million US dollars for all of these leaders to meet.
Spectacular.
You know why this is a joke? Is hey, you know what? We think you're in $100 million worth of danger. You know what we should do? Let's all gather in a tiny little place. Because we think you're in so much danger, let's put you all in one place, right? This is a good idea.
And make sure everybody knows that you're in that place.
Yes. Yes. And then let's spend $100 million to make you unsafe. We think you're unsafe. Mm. Let's spend $100 million in a COVID economy, which we're telling. And these are the same people that are telling us the economy is shrinking. These are the very same people.
Yep. Unbelievable.
What a bunch of knobs.
All right, it's time for Blind History. Sia, are we gonna play the audio? What are we doing?
Yeah, then we have the audio, and then we also have a graphic for this morning as well.
All right. Let me just see, because I'm gonna try and do this myself on this side. You want me to try?
Yes, please.
All right. I'm gonna try and do this because if I can get this right, then we may be able to do this properly. So this is the audio from my side, but you'll be able to watch the whole video on YouTube a little bit later on. It's going to be very, very exciting. This is an episode of Blind History, which involves Nostradamus. And Nostradamus, for anybody who doesn't know, Nostradamus, famously the guy who predicted all kinds of stuff that they say is still going on around us. They said that, for example, 9/11, when the World Trade Center was destroyed, he predicted that, apparently. There are people who say that Nostradamus predicted, plenty of good stuff. They're saying that he was really he was so ahead of his time, this guy. And he only wrote a few quatrains of stuff down. But according to all the experts, the Nostradamus experts, that is, he was well ahead of his time and knew everything that was going on. So if you're interested in Nostradamus, that's coming up. Also, by the way, if you'd like to suggest any ideas of who you'd like us to cover in Blind History, particularly because we're coming to the end of this season of Blind History, and we'd like to know from you where you'd like us to go next, what you'd like us to be focused on for the next couple of episodes, then do email me, gareth@cliffcentral.com. I would love to hear from you. I'd love to know what you would like to hear about next, and you can be a part of the Blind History creative process. We want to hear all of the suggestions that you might have. You can get hold of us on the email address, gareth@cliffcentral.com, and be a part of it. All right, it is time for us to play the latest episode in Blind History. I'm going to do this off of here. Hang on a second, Sia, and then we can play it properly. I just got to figure this out. I know how to do this because
I'm just going to nod and
We played Jane's voice, her insults from here, so this should work quite well. All right, here it is. Nostradamus, the video will be available on cliffcentral.com a little bit later today. Make sure that you don't miss it. In the 1500s, one man had shadowy powers of prediction. Nostradamus. Hidden clues, secret double meanings, and confusing portents in his cryptic poems seemed to foreshadow events that unfolded over hundreds of years after his death. To this day, some people find clues about war, plague, the destruction of nations, and the rise of evil men in every quatrain. Others see meaningless bunk, preferring to rank Nostradamus as a fraud rather than a soothsayer. Did he have incredible abilities? Or was he just a madman, high on opiates, inventing fantastic tales to impress his patrons? No one will ever know. But not even Nostradamus could have predicted that his name would echo as it has through history. Nostradamus. It's a name that has become a word that people use to describe someone who thinks that they know more than they can possibly know. He was a real person. And this episode of Blind History, which is brought to you, as always, by Taylor Blinds and Shutters, my co-host, Anthony Miedera, we're going to tell you about Nostradamus. Well, as much as we can, because, you know, some people believe he can still tell you more than anybody else, even though he's been dead for hundreds of years. What's your feel on Michel de Nostradamus?
I think it's more about the need of humans to know what's about to happen next. When looking at him and doing research on him, very intelligent person, but sure, there's just so much gray area around what he did. It's very hard for me to believe any of this. But yeah, he's made a massive impression, probably post his life.
You know, when we started doing Blind History, we made a decision that we weren't going to do mythological people. They would have to have been real people. And he certainly was that. I mean, he was born we actually have a rough date, somewhere in December 1503, and he died in about 1566. And we know that he was French and he was extremely well educated. As you said, he was also a physician, an author, a translator. He was an astrologer, but he was probably a better doctor than he was a prophesier of the future.
Correct.
And it's hard for people who are skeptical like you and I are to take someone like this seriously for the thing that he is most famous for. But I mean, he's an interesting guy nonetheless. He was obviously extremely smart. He went to two different universities as part of his education. He came from a middle-class family. They were Jewish by descent. And his uncle, I think it was, converted to Catholicism. And that's where the name Nostradamus came from, right?
Correct. And at this particular time, and we've covered it a lot in previous Blind History episodes, it was really difficult being Jewish at the time. And there was also the Spanish Inquisition and the Inquisition actually all over Europe that was happening at the time. And then there was Henry VIII splitting from the church. It was the Wild West actually in terms of religion.
Whatever your religion was, you were in trouble with somebody.
Exactly. 100% right.
But it's never been particularly easy for the Jews in Europe until very recently, you know?
Yeah. So I think that played out as well very much in his whole life, and he had to be very, very careful of how he worded his prophecies.
Yeah, I mean, when he was at university, he studied to be a doctor, and that was at the University of Montpellier, and he was pretty much expelled before he'd even begun because he was working as an apothecary, which was not allowed. You know, there was this idea that being an apothecary was so different from being a doctor that the two weren't actually in the same business at all. Of course, now these days, you know, your doctor gives you a prescription and you go to your pharmacist and you get what you need. But apothecaries were also these mythological creatures too. They also believed that, you know, there was a philosopher's stone and they didn't necessarily know the details of actual chemistry or pharmacology. It was much more of a guessing game and it was tied to the stars and it was tied to the humors inside the body. So I think that probably put a break on his initial ambitions and aspirations, but by no means did he stop. And in fact, there've been some really good reports from firsthand witnesses that as a doctor, he was very proficient when he eventually did get his doctorate. He was able to help people who were dying from the plague. He developed a vitamin C concentrate that people were able to drink to help them get through flus and colds.
You know, it makes a lot of sense why he was successful because he did talk about massive amounts of vitamin C, sunlight, getting out into the country because people got confused that they thought that when they heard about the plague, which is what we're really talking about in this period, they used to lock themselves in their homes, but it was coming from the rats, the fleas from the rats. So actually it was better to get out in the open and go into the countryside. And those people that took his advice would actually recover from it together with these. They were basically just a whole lot of different vitamins that he put together, which just helped the immune system.
He was almost more like a dietitian biokineticist than anything else, because he told people, for example, that a low-fat diet and lots of fresh air was a good idea. And remember, in those days, that was quite revolutionary information. I mean, correct. People were treating minor disorders with leeches, and they were bleeding people from the head. And I mean, doctors were basically just butchers.
And he stopped that bleeding process in his practice. He didn't do that.
Right.
And I think that was the number one go-to for most doctors in those times.
So he did get married, and he was married in 1531. His wife and two children all died in 1534 during the plague, which also must have affected him very badly. I mean, there's a lot of his predictions and his poetry, even if you don't believe it's predictions, even if you just look at it as poetry, it's very dark and very gloomy. Very ominous. And it might have been as a result of living in those times and, you know, losing family members and having the stresses that, that life in the 1500s brought with it.
And, you know, it was one of his, not disappointments is really a soft word in this case, but it broke him that he couldn't save his own family. He saved so many people from the plague and he could not manage to save his own family. So it destroyed him and he just disappeared on travels, trying to find himself and just let the pain heal. And also, it did tarnish his reputation a bit in terms of healing people if he couldn't heal his own family. So there was a bit of both that was in play here in this part of his life.
He remarried later on to a woman called Anne Ponsard, and he had 6 children with her. He also wrote an almanac in 1550, which was a massive success. An almanac, sort of a book that gave you the, you know, the position of the moon and the position of the stars and a calendar. And that was a big deal in those days because people didn't really plan much in advance. Every day was more or less like the previous day, maybe a bit warmer or a bit colder. And for him to plan out a year was a fairly revolutionary move as well. I mean, almanacs were well known, but for him to produce his own, it was quite a work of scientific and I suppose social genius. Maybe it was also what lay underneath as the scaffolding for what would become his quatrains of predictions later on. His big patron, of course, was Catherine of Medici, who was a big supporter of his. And she obviously was part of the reason that he could eventually finance and publish La Prophétise, which was his Les Prophéties, rather, which is his book of prophecies.
But his second wife, she was a widow and she was very wealthy. So that assisted him a lot as well to be able to actually follow, you know, his true passion, which was the quatrains. And that's what he started to write. And little did we know, the world knew that his life was quite, it was going to be cut reasonably short, I suppose, even for that time. In the 50s, he was only going to be living another 10 years or something.
Right. So let's get to the part that people are probably most interested in. I mean, Nostradamus is supposed to, in his prophecies book, have written about things that were going to happen. And there are many of these prophecies, and I've written down about 8 of the ones that I think may or may not have some veracity. They certainly have been taken very seriously by people who believe in these kinds of things. And he was an occultist, so he had studied Jewish Kabbalah and the occult more generally in terms of Christian views on it. And he was regarded by some people as being very dangerous, but he was also supposed to have had supernatural abilities to predict the future. And we can go through a few of these. I mean, supposedly he predicted with fair accuracy the French Revolution. You know, he said people would lose their heads. I mean, it was in those exact words. He may or may not have predicted the rise of Louis Pasteur and the defeat of bacteria and bacterial infection. He even called him pastor, as in Christian priest. But a lot of people say that that was just a sobriquet for Pasteur, the guy who eventually developed penicillin. He's supposed to have predicted the 2 bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki because he spoke about these 2 explosions and then plague within plague and a famine that came afterwards in 2 great cities. And, you know, you could probably have found, because a lot of his language is quite general, you could have found some other examples in history of, you know, 2 cities that were battling each other that perhaps didn't involve atomic bombs at all. But a lot of people say that that's very close to the Hiroshima Nagasaki story. Supposedly, he predicted the rise of Napoleon.
Correct. But the way he wrote all these prophecies is in such a way that he wouldn't get the attention of the church. So, you know, people that support his prophecies obviously say he had to word it in such a way that it was quite difficult to determine that he was, so he didn't end up being a charlatan or whatever it might be. But,
well, I mean, look, the most dangerous thing that could happen in those days was probably that they would call you a heretic and burn you at the stake.
Correct.
Considering, you know, he already had to overcome a number of things to just be able to write freely. And then a lot of people say, well, if you keep it general, then it turns out that a lot more of your predictions look like they're true. He was supposed to have predicted 9/11, where he said 2 steel birds will crash into tall buildings. And, you know, again, that's quite specific and it is alarming if it's even close to the truth. A lot of people say, well, you know, that's about as close as you could get in 1500.
Yeah. And then killing of President John F. Kennedy. He speaks about it from on high, and evil will fall on the great man, perhaps a reference to the fact that he was shot from a distance by snipers or sniper. And then continues that dead innocent will be accused of the deed. And there's, you know, the whole story around did Lee Harvey Oswald.
Right.
Was he the one, et cetera, et cetera. So that's another one. And the death of Henry II of France was also reasonably accurate. It wasn't in battle, but it was jousting, but it was very similar. And he predicted that he would die a very painful death through the eye. And it's exactly what happened. A soldier lanced him through the eye and it just got infected and septic. It took 10 days to die. The one of interest to me is obviously the coming of Adolf Hitler. That was quite interesting, his prophecy on that.
Do you have the lines?
He refers to it from the depths of West Europe. Nostradamus wrote, a young child will be born of poor people. And what does this child do? He will by his tongue seduce a great troop, and his fame will be spread far beyond Europe. And then it also refers in this one to Hister, which could be a reference to Hitler, or that was also a name for the Danube, an older name for the Danube. So that was another interesting thing.
I mean, you can't really tell me that there's anyone else in history who seduced by his tongue a large troop. I mean, that to me just sounds, that's very much like the kind of oratory power that Hitler had. Correct. A large troop. I mean, the German troops are probably the most famous mental image any of us have, with those helmets and those, those German Nazi uniforms. That's burnt into our minds if you've studied history at all. And yes, for him to have seen that in advance, or to have been able to write something like that in advance, it's kind of spooky, I will admit.
The Great Fire of London.
Yeah, that's on my list as well. So do you actually have the lines that are supposed to have predicted the Great Fire?
The blood of just will commit a fault at London, burned through lightning of 23 the 6th. The ancient lady will fall from her high place. Several of the same sect will be killed. 23 the 6th. 66. So it's 20 times 3 plus 6. That gives you the term of, so it was 1666 was the Great Fire. Obviously, post that, you can start, putting anything together to get to that.
This is the thing. And again, I don't want to spoil it for people who are real fans of Nostradamus, because they'll probably be the ones who like this episode the most. And to say, look, a lot of this stuff could probably be retro-engineered to sound like it was very specific. But you know how people are. They find, they count the spaces between words in the Bible, and they say there's a secret code. And, there may be, in many places that we don't expect there to be, there may be secrets and real powers and unbelievable things that we are unable to, in modern scientific terms, decipher properly or explain. But we're not in the business of supporting or declaring his prophecies rubbish. I think we're just in the business today of looking at some of them.
Some of the things that you look at are quite scary. When you look at metal in the sky, when he starts referring to maybe 9/11, et cetera, or fireballs, there will be two big fireballs. I mean, it's quite scary. And what makes you think of that? It's so hard to judge.
They took a couple of his quatrains, and the reason they're called quatrains is because he wrote four lines at a time. So they were almost like poems. And four of the quatrains are fairly clearly about some sort of creature that will be made of metal, that will have fire on the inside, that will do all the work. And he's pretty much discussing in that quatrain. And remember, with a 1500s brain, there was no mechanization then.
Correct.
What he's talking about is how machines, robots or mechanical devices will do a lot of the work for humans, that humans are doing at the time that he writes this. And that is, if nothing else, it's quite extraordinary that he was able to pull that out of thin air, because it wasn't something that you would have said in 1500 without being laughed at in public. A machine to them, the most complicated machines around at that time were probably, devices used to lift stones. Whatever this guy had, he certainly had an ability to make people take notice. And we mentioned some of his wealthy patrons earlier on, and many popular authors have retold all kinds of legends about his life. I mean, he's supposed to have had magical powers. This is where it starts getting into the messy world of nonsense and make-believe. But he was widely read, so he'd read a lot of the classics. Apparently, one of his sources for his prophecies was something called the Mirabilis Liber of 1522, which contained a range of prophecies from all kinds of people, including Savonarola, who we've spoken about in a previous episode, Tibertine Sibyl, Pseudo Methodius, and Joachim of Fiore, who all sound like interesting people themselves. But it had a lot of success in the years before he published his prophecies. So some people say, well, he got a lot of his ideas from there as well.
I think as well, Gareth, on this point, history repeats itself. So they were saying that he used that that history will repeat itself, and to such an extent, referring back to very old occurrences, and they called it bibliomancy. I think that, I don't know if that's the correct pronunciation, but it refers back to biblical times and then trying to predict it going forward in the future. So that was also areas where sources for his prophecies.
Well, I mean, he wasn't very keen to have been called a prophet. He wrote to King Henry II, the same guy who he predicted would die so horribly, said to him, "Some of the prophets predicted great and marvelous things to come, though for me, I in no way attribute to myself such a title here." That he wrote to the king in 1558. And he's supposed to have said to his own children, you know, "I'm not a prophet. I would never attribute such a thing to myself." But of course, when people speak like that, it's like a false humility.
Yeah, exactly. And the astrologers were also not very kind to him. I mean, you know, they would say that the astrologers of the time would say, I can say with complete confidence that of true astrology, you understand less than nothing, as is evident not merely to the learned, but to the learners in astrology too. As your works amply demonstrate, you who cannot calculate the least movement of any heavenly body whatsoever. So he had his, obviously he had his critics in his time, but you know, nobody knows the name of that astrologer that wrote that piece, but everybody knows Nostradamus.
Well, I mean, this is what's so interesting. So in popular culture, obviously he's become this unbelievable source of all kinds of prophecy, but the problem with Nostradamus's prophecies is they should have run out at some point. You know, the more time you give a prophecy to come true over, you know, thousands and thousands of years, there's a huge likelihood that all of them will eventually come true.
Yeah.
Even if you read it upside down, it'll eventually come true. But the fact is that, you know, people are still saying, well, he had all kinds of predictions for 2020 and 2021. He didn't lay it out like a calendar. You have to find some verse, some quatrain somewhere, and you have to say, oh, well, he's definitely talking about 2020 here, because he didn't put there 14th of April, 2021, X and Y will happen.
Yeah, and how far ahead did he actually think? Maybe they said, you know, he was on those magic mushrooms, and then there's time is no concept. So maybe that's his predictions could be of any time.
Yeah,
but that's also a stretch, you know. So it's getting the dates together and working out what it applies to. Look, these massive events, like you mentioned with Hitler, it's actually quite close, and that's the spooky part.
Hmm.
And then, and Henry II, look, that was very much in his own time. Henry II was quite spooky. So that's hard to say. But then there's a lot of them that are all over the place.
So I think this guy was a pretty interesting chap. Even if we don't take any of his prophecies seriously, he certainly made a name for himself. I mean, anybody who can go down in history with one word as their name, Cleopatra, Caesar, Nostradamus, these are people who've managed to make themselves iconic in some way. And he certainly did that. I mean, he you know, he died kind of ignominiously, left a will for his children. Everything was well prepared. You would expect a guy who was a prophet to leave a decent will behind, and he did that. So he made sure everything was taken care of. It was all very tidy after his death, because there's nothing worse than a psychic who doesn't know when they're going to die.
Exactly.
And then they leave everything in disarray.
And he was quite wealthy, from what he achieved through his life.
No, he did well. You know, whether you believe anything that he wrote down or not, these days we have the internet, and you could find some dark corner of the internet that predicts with fair degrees of accuracy something that's going to happen tomorrow. Doesn't mean we go around calling everybody prophets, but if someone really thinks they know what's happening next, we end up calling them Nostradamus. Blind History is brought to you by Taylor Blinds and Shutters. All the episodes are available on the cliffcentral.com website and app, as well as Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. I found it interesting that he predicted his own death. I mean, the night of his death, he wrote down, "In the morning, you shall not find me breathing." And that's exactly what happened. It wasn't a poem. It wasn't some cryptic thing. He just said to his secretary, I think, who found the note, there he was, dead the next day.
I suppose it's hard to say in the 1500s, but it sounded like a heart attack.
Supposedly, it was from gout. He had severe gout towards the end of his life, and it might have developed into an edema, which is a heart attack. CliffCentral.com.